morning's session is entitled The Geography of the Soul. I'm John Magnuson, I'm your facilitator, and look forward to the time with you this morning, and also perhaps for those of you who return the other sessions later during the week. I'd like to suggest that we bless our time together because we're entering a kind of sacred ground, and would like to do that by having some scripture read for us, and have asked that Psalm 139, the first 13 verses, be read to bless us. So at this point, we will hear from scripture.
Lord, you have searched me out and known me. You know my sitting down and my rising up. You discern my thoughts from afar. You trace my journeys and my resting places and are acquainted with all my ways. Indeed, there is not a word on my lips, but you, O Lord, know it altogether. You press upon me behind and before and lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is so high that I cannot attain to it. Where can I go then from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I climb up to heaven, you are there. If I make the grave my bed, you are there also. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there your hand will lead me, and your right hand hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness will cover me, and a light around me turn to night, darkness is not dark to you. The night is as bright as the day. Darkness and light to you are both alike. For you yourself created my inmost parts. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I will thank you because I am marvelously made. Your works are wonderful, and I know it well.
The psalmist there writes of a great force that lies and surround us, that held us before we were knit in our mother's womb, and that no matter how far we go, up or down into the depths of hell itself, there is that presence, that loving presence that is there even deeper still. I would just like to begin by saying that the plan for this morning is that I would like to share just a few personal reflections on how I became involved in this world of dreams. Part of that story entails Holden Village here back in 1980. But then also to touch very briefly on some research about sleep patterns and dreaming, which I find very fascinating. That's been developed over the last 10 or 15 years. And then would like to present a very brief map for us to work with for the rest of the week. And I'm going to use this board here to illustrate it. And then we'll just spend the rest of the time talking and sharing our feelings and questions, perceptions. Some autobiographical reflections. 10 years ago, if there was such a workshop offered at Holden, I would not have come, because I did not believe, this may seem incredulous to some of you, but I did not believe I dreamed. I could recall a few dreams that I'd had when I was a child. Once in a while, I would recall a nightmare or something, but for the most part, I did not put much weight or value on that inner world in terms of dreams. I did and have married someone who has a very, very effusive and elaborate dream life. She is an illustrator and artist and will be up here next week. She never really knew what to do with her dreams. She just knew that oftentimes whole days would be set asunder and off balance because of powerful dreams that she would have during the night, sometimes humorous, other times frightening. And so I was a kind of stabilizing force in our marriage, and we would frequently talk about dreams in the family, but really didn't have a framework or any kind of guideline what really to do with them. I was trained as a pastor, and also received training in a psychiatric hospital as a therapist, University of Wisconsin. And in both cases, I was never asked on one occasion about my personal dream life. So I was not prepared by any kind of my theological training, nor was I prepared by my secular psychotherapeutic training to deal with dreams. How I stumbled upon this world, or how this world kind of stumbled upon me, occurred because of an Indian instructor I had in graduate school. And I was on a search during that time, for a connection between religion and psychology, from the psychiatric community to the religious community. And I found that, with few exceptions, there was much suspicion and antagonism between those two disciplines. It was in the Indian community that I found that their clergymen or medicine people not only led rituals and were the teachers of the tradition, like we are pastors in our own Lutheran community, but that among Indian people, medicine women and medicine men also are healers. And they are healers not only with herbs and medicinal plants, but also with rituals and with dreams. My teachers over these last years have been then members of the Indian community, members of the Roman Catholic Church, who in their deep history and tradition still, among some of the monastic orders, take dreams very, very seriously, and also the Episcopalian community, of whose members include John Sanford's mother's name was Agnes, who was a devotional writer during the 50s. John is a Jungian analyst now living in San Diego. And also Morton Kelsey, kind of the grandfather of dream work in the Christian community. Kelsey used to teach at Notre Dame and now is retired. Those have been my teachers, along with my children and my wife Diana. When I first entered this dream world personally, it was on this porch in 1980, September 26th. I came up to Holden Village. I was a new pastor in Oregon. There was no place for me to sleep because I had, and I'll make a confession here for the first time publicly, I jumped the boat without a reservation. I had not made a reservation. So I came up here with a couple hundred clergy people, and there was no room in the inn, so I slept on the porch, and decided one night to follow some very simple techniques, which I will share with you at the end of the hour, so you could honor that dream world this week, those of you who choose. I used some techniques to prepare myself to listen to my dreams, of which I was unsure that perhaps, you know, I didn't know really if that world was inside of me. And so it was here that I wrote down my first dream. I woke up in the middle of the night and wrote it down. It's quite an embarrassing dream, and I've actually never told it in public, and probably still am not ready to, but perhaps at a later time, years from now, I will. As you know, those of you who are dreamers, sometimes dreams can be incredibly embarrassing, as well as humorous and frightening, and so that's my story. In the years since then, I have taught in the Honors College at Oregon State University. I've done numerous dream workshops for churches, most of them logging towns in Oregon. And they have been fascinating experiences as people have carried their dreams, experiences of dreams for years and never felt permission to share them. And I have been the recipient of wonderful, wonderful gifts of people who have shared powerful experiences in their lives. Any dream that I will share with you during this series, and I will share with you many, dozens of my own and other people's that I've worked with, no dream will be shared with you without their permission. And I've asked in each of the instances if I could use their dream in another place, and they have given me permission. I say that because I want to protect the very sacred nature of your own inner world. I have made many mistakes in past years by stepping into other people's inner space without permission. And I've also stepped in at the wrong time. And they've invited me in, but it's been the wrong time and wrong place. So we'll talk a little bit about that also in future sessions, about when you do dream work, where you should do it, and who you might want to do it with. Now the series this week, after this morning, session two tomorrow will be a session on the Bible, dreams, and you, where I'll seek to start to make connections with the scriptural tradition of which we come. Five dreams surrounded the birth of Jesus, for instance, and there are over 224 direct dream references in Scripture. The whole book of Revelation is a dream image. And we'll talk about Daniel and some of the major key dreams in Scripture, and why, in fact, dreams are not talked about anymore in the church for the most part. The more conservative Christians in the ecumenical community feel that God revealed himself through Scripture and then stopped. And that is the revelation, the Old and New Testament. So it's not that God can't talk to us through our dreams, but God has chosen not to. Now, among the liberal community, of which most of us represent, are representative of, I believe, although we wouldn't want to admit this in public, I think, from a podium or pulpit, the fact of the matter is, most of us believe God can't speak through dreams. So you've got the fundamentalists believing God won't speak through dreams, and you've got your liberals believing God can't speak through dreams, that was primarily a kind of superstitious understanding of the world. And so that's how great portions of the religious community have ignored this language, which is now resurfacing, especially, as I mentioned, among the Roman Catholic and Episcopal communities. The dream world, personally for me, I say unabashedly, has in several cases, I think, well, I know, has made me a better parent. And I believe a better husband. I think it has also warned me about certain dangers in my profession. And the dream world, I believe also on one level, I think has saved my life, at least emotionally, which of course has physical implications. So I'm very honored to be invited to be with you and to share what I have seen and felt but more importantly, to try to connect with you this week and invite you to reclaim that power, that sanctuary, that kingdom that is within you. That is what my hope is, and I'll be glad to visit with any of you outside the formal sessions, and perhaps toward the end of the week we will maybe be able to do some dream work, what I call live TV stuff here. So we won't talk about dreams in the past. We can actually do some dream work if the setting is right, and if the community feels that's appropriate. Okay, let me begin with just a few comments on what the scientific community and medical community have given us in terms of sleep and dream research in the last 15 years. Most of this, there's a lot about dreams being written now in popular magazines, so I'm sure this is familiar to some of you, but most of these insights have come to us through the use of a piece of medical technology called the EEG, the electroencephalogram. Have any of you had one of those on you? Okay. Basically, there consists of a number of electrodes that are fastened to different parts of the skull and body, and they record dream or brain waves. And what happened was they were able to use this piece of technology when people fell asleep. They were interested, the researchers, to discover what went on when people went to sleep. And so there was a whole new field of study that emerged. And there are sleep clinics that are found now all over the country. But here are some of the conclusions that they came to. First of all, their studies are, and this was done cross-culturally around the world, the need for sleep is fairly consistent among the human species. Roughly, no matter what culture you go to, what ancient primitive tribe or primal tribe you investigate, the need for sleep for the human animal is roughly the same, and it goes somewhere between 7 and 8 hours. Now, I know that many of you may take issue with that, but I will just counterpose you before you do by saying you're either probably living with sleep deprivation, that's why you're jacking yourself up with coffee in the morning, and it's very much true for our society, or you may be catnapping or finding other ways, dozing to capture that amount of sleep that you need. Now there are, of course, this is an average, there are exceptions. But I know several people who feel it a weakness if they need more than 7 hours of sleep. They have somehow feel guilty about that. And when you come into the dream world, you'll see how wonderful sleep is and how important sleep is. You're welcome. Your need for sleep. The other thing they identified was two different types of sleep, and they are fancy names for them. One's called REM sleep, and the other is called non-REM sleep. And they stand for rapid eye movement. If you look at somebody when they're asleep, your child or your spouse or your mate or your lover, their eyes will flicker underneath the eyelid, just like this. And what the research has shown is when you awaken the person during REM sleep, there will be an image, they will be dreaming. And during the non-REM sleep, the body is completely relaxed, and that's what we call kind of a deep sleep, in which the body just is very quiet, and there's not much activity going on in terms of brain waves. They also identified that REM sleep is fairly consistent too among people, about 20% of the time. And you dream, you REM sleep during intervals of about 90 minutes. So in other words, your dream sleep each night is spread out in small increments. Your longest dream period, roughly before you wake up. They also discovered two ways we'll repress REM sleep. Two things can repress REM sleep. One is sedatives, and one is alcohol. And one of the problems in psychiatric facilities with people with insomnia, for instance, they need to sleep. They need to have the REM sleep, so they take sedatives to get to sleep. And they sleep 14 hours, but they get up and they're not rested. Why? Because this REM sleep never happened, or it was suppressed. And that was one of the problems with using a lot of sedatives to relax. The implications for alcoholism here and alcohol abuse is real fascinating too, but that's a separate issue. The only other thing I will say is the other study that was real interesting I found was that the studies in REM deprivation, in other words, what they would do with candidates would be when these people would fall asleep, every time they would REM sleep, they'd be woken up. And what they found was after 3 or 4 days being denied of REM sleep, the person would fall, go to bed, and rather than 20% of the time REM sleeping, they'd be up to 80%. So the conclusions here are self-evident too. Somehow we are built, our psyches are built, where we need to dream. And one of the correlations of that with the Indian native populations on the Northwest Coast is that they will go and fast and stay awake for 2 or 3 days so they can trigger the REM sleep. The other, maybe a last comment on the dream research has to do with infants, because I know we have several in the village. When my daughter was born and I was a new father, I thought kids sleep 16 hours a day. And in many cases they do. And I thought, well, gee, they just might probably just relaxing and growing. But what the research has shown, and if you watch your child sleep, REM sleep is up to 90% in infants. So what that may be indicating is that although physically they are resting, their little psyche or personality or their soul, or whatever you want to say it, their mind is continually forming, trying to put together images, trying to connect, trying to make sense out of all this light and color and sound that they're experiencing. So that's something on, I was asking Leo about animals in REM sleep. There are all kinds of interesting studies about that too, but we'll wait till tonight for the human-animal bond to talk about that. Any questions about this research?
But Don, one thing that
Leo, sure.
Is that on the REM, on the dreams in children up to age of 5 or 6, I think 70% of them are above animals.
Okay,
it's
wonderful. Nice
to work on that.
Remember this, especially in our future sessions. On Wednesday, we'll be talking about the dynamics of the dream world and the archetypes of the inner life. We'll talk about animals a lot. It's very predominant images in dreams. So that's wonderful. Thank you, Leo. Any other questions regarding this very cursory look at REM sleep? Yeah.
So in non-REM, you don't dream in that?
No.
And if you're woken up in non-REM, you aren't.
You won't remember a dream, no. Yes.
Do you think that you can get as restful a condition by being hypnotized?
Okay. Let me say that for about, in just a few minutes, we go over the psyche, the diagram of the psyche, because I'm going to talk about hypnosis.
Okay.
And I think that'll be explanatory. What I'd like to do now is to move to a map. So that when we begin to move into the dream world, we'll have some common ground. Now, this is one map And those of you who have come to Holden probably have seen many maps either on your way here or after arriving at the village. And you know there's a lot of different kinds of maps. So I'm not claiming this is the only map there is for the psyche, but I'm suggesting that it will be one that we can look at that I think has a lot of important connections with our Christian faith and our understanding of ourselves as persons created in God's image, and also has roots in the scientific analytical community. I'm going to call this a map of the psyche. The word psyche, I'd like to just honor for a moment. I'm going to use the word a lot during the week. The word is the root word, it's a Greek word. It's used a lot in the medical community as well as in street language. Can you give me a few examples of it? Derivatives from the word psyche?
Psyched out.
Psyched out. Psychosomatic.
Psychotic.
Psychiatric. Psychiatrist. Psychotropic drugs. The word is translated by on the street usually as if somebody's in a psychiatric ward, they're in a mental hospital. Somebody's got a psychiatric illness that they're mentally ill. But that's not a true translation of the word psyche. The word is from Greek. It means spirit or soul, wind. Now, interesting implications, huh? If somebody had a psychiatric illness, you could say they're either mentally ill or their soul was sick. They had a soul sickness. But we have chosen, which I think you'll become conscious of in this week together, why this is avoided. You don't hear a language like spirit or soul on psychiatric wards. There's a reason for it, and we'll talk about it. You will, ironically enough, be bombarded with all kinds of religious imagery. Angels, Jesus, you'll meet Jesus, the Virgin Mary, as well as St. Paul, Peter, and the devil, and all other kinds of angels. Now, I'm going to use here a circle to begin with and suggest that the psyche, or the soul, your soul, my soul, resembles an iceberg and that we only are able to perceive a bit of it here. I'm going to give it a name. I'm going to call it the ego. The ego is that part of the psyche which is self-conscious. If I were to describe to you who I am, my credentials, my profession, my self-understanding, I would be speaking out of my ego. It's the world of language, it's the world of consciousness. We are not born with an ego. We have to build the ego. And the ego is a very important function and part of who we are. A lot of times you hear a casual conversation in which people kind of put down people with strong egos. Well, she or he has a strong ego. A strong ego is a wonderful, wonderful thing to have. A strong ego enables you to relate to the world. The ego is the part of us that relates to the outside world. It's the competitive part. It's the part that is able to be self-disciplined, get up and go to work, be able to get in a fight with your boss and not run away and cry in the bathroom. It's the part of you that can take on your pastor in your church when you feel there is something that needs to be taken on. The strong ego is a gift, and one of the tasks of the first part of our lives is to build the ego and help our children learn how to feel good about themselves. It has to do with people's self-image.
Then why is egotistical such a negative word?
Sure. I'll mention that in a moment here. Let me just keep going. We'll pop back to you, Grace. According to this understanding of the psyche, however, the real action is down here. Down here. This is what I'm going to give it a name. I'm going to call it the unconscious. Now, most articles you read in popular magazines about psychology, written by psychologists and Joyce Brothers and others, have to do what I call ego psychology. Basically, how you cope with anger, how you communicate better with your spouse, how you can deal with conflict with your kids, how you deal with grief. It has to do with functioning or adapting to the outer world, and it's very important. It's a little bit like teaching a person how to move and relate, how to get along in the world. But I'm suggesting this morning, when we move into the dream world, that there's another part of the psyche that's very important. It's called the unconscious. And it's much stronger than the ego. It's much bigger. Now, what's down here? What's in here? Well, you can see what's in there if you go to a nursery school or you go to a psych ward. You can see it. There's all kinds of things in it. There are monsters in it. There are fears in it. There are wishes in it. There is angels in it. There's all kinds of pain in it, grief. It's like a boiling cauldron that's inside of us. And there is a difference of opinion about the forces that seek to find some kind to coalesce and to form and to push on the ego. There's a difference of opinion about it.